Hi, and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I am Romain Guy from the Android Toolkit team.
That was very exciting. I think that's your first intro to the podcast.
I believe so,
wow.
Yes.
Wow. It's a historic episode. I am Chet Haas from the Developer Relations team.
And today we have two special guests, Chet
Hello.
And myself.
Today is going to be the Inside Baseball episode. So normally, we align guests with our schedules weeks, even months in advance, right? Like we've got, you should see the pipeline for this thing, incredibly organized. Or we get up to, you know, a day or two before we do the episode and we think, oh, who do we know that do we think would be free for an hour on Wednesday afternoon? And this week we did that and we were sort of stretched for ideas, but we thought, you know, maybe we can talk about some of what we do for outreach. So I have recently moved into a role where I do that for my actual job, but for all of the rest of the time that I was at Google.
You finally stopped pretending you were an engineer.
Yeah, basically. I'm doing the thing for real that I used to do for fake for a hobby for years and years, and before I joined this company as well. And in the meantime...
Chet is pointing at me. I'm not sure what you want me to say.
So Romain has been doing this stuff for years as well.
Yeah, and mostly because of you, I believe.
Really? Well, that was my fault?
Yes, I think so.
Oh, you seem pretty happy to jump up there on stage.
No, I'm happy to do it. But the way it started was when we worked together at Sun Microsystems. I think you were already giving talks.
Yes.
And I was an intern there, and either you or someone else, you know, Java 1, the big conference back then was happening, and said, hey, do you want to join us in front of 1,000 people? Which makes sense, because I think I'd been in the US for a grand total of 3 weeks. So, you know, it's an interesting way to get started for public speaking.
Was that the original Filthy Rich Clients talk, or was that the talk that
It was either Filthy Rich Clients or Extreme GUI Makeover,
yeah.
Or maybe both. I don't remember the exact.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, it seemed to work. So I had been doing talks on that team for probably 3 or 4 years at that point, sort of getting increasingly interested in doing more
of
that.
So here's a question for you, because, you know, I just explained how I got started, which was mostly by accident / me being crazy enough to say yes. It sounded scary, so I decided, why not? But what about you? Because I know I've met a lot of developers who are interested in doing public speaking, both at Google and outside, and they don't really know how to get started.
Yep.
And in my experience, getting started just a matter of getting up on stage.
Yeah. Turn on the microphone.
So what made you start?
So the team gave talks, much like we do here, right? If you have a developer platform, the people who wrote the platform should probably help people understand how to use it. And so people on the client team were giving talks. And there was a need for talk about, I don't know, gaming stuff or performance or graphics. And I thought, sure, I'll try that thing. And I think for me, starting out, like the talks that I gave then are very different than the talks I gave now, because I thought very clearly and organized my thoughts and my slides and speaker notes and said, here's what I will say on this slide and here's what I'll say on the next slide, which I think is a reasonable way to start out. You sort of want to... You need to figure out what it is you're saying very carefully until you get comfortable up there and realize that you can improv a bunch as well and be a little more sketchy on details and organization.
Well, and that's not for everybody, right?
Yeah, true. Very experienced speakers are still, they tend to be much more organized than we do on our talks. I think I gave a couple of those talks, like, you know, because this is a necessary thing. And I think, like, as of the first one, you're like, oh, this is actually really fun. That feeling you get on stage is not the feeling that you get writing code or doing anything else.
You mean that feeling of dread?
Partly. Absolutely. Yeah. Like the adrenaline, the nervousness that frankly never goes away. Nope. So I think that's probably something that people should realize too, is like, oh, well, when I get used to this, then, you know, it won't be scary. No.
Sorry, you don't.
No. It's, you just need to reinterpret that fear as positive energy.
I told that to a bunch of people. The main trick is, if it looks like you know what you're talking about, then the audience will believe you, even though on the inside you're going, oh my God, what's going on? What am I going to say?
Yep. That's true. I've heard people mention this as well, sort of this fear that, well, if I get up on stage, obviously I have to be the smartest person in the room, or I have to be, you know, the world's
Never
greatest
happened
expert.
To us.
No. I think the interesting thing I've noticed over the years is first of all, be honest about what you don't know. And I think the audience appreciates that. Like, I'm not going to answer a question with something that I don't know. You know, if they ask me a question that's not in my wheelhouse, I'm happy to say, I just don't know the answer to that one. And then you can try to follow up with them to get them the information they need.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure every time we made the mistake of not saying, I don't know, we gave a wrong answer and at least someone noticed.
Yes.
So just don't try that.
Yeah, chances are there are a lot of people in the room that know more than you on specific areas of what you're talking about. I think you are the expert in a particular part of this thing, and I think the audience gives you that, right? I don't think that they're sitting there, you know, critically tapping their fingers waiting for you to screw up and say something wrong.
Well, I'm pretty sure there's always one person in the audience who's there just for that purpose.
And you know what? You are not giving the talk for them. You're giving it for everyone else in the audience. So I think a lot of it for me getting comfortable on stage was realizing you don't have to be the expert. It doesn't have to be a perfect thing. Not every talk is a TED talk that has to be, you know, carefully choreographed. Instead, you're just up there imparting the information that you happen to know something about because you care about it, right? That's a key part to me, is like actually having a passion about it. And then that passion communicates itself to the audience.
Well, I would say, yeah, that's the core of it, because, you know, having pretty slides, having rehearsed your talk perfectly, not making any mistake, will make the talk slightly better. But if you start from a topic you don't know very well or that you don't care about, the talk will not be good. And no matter how you dress it, it won't be a good talk. But we've certainly given, and I don't assume that all our talks are great, but I know we've given a number of talks that seemed well received, where our slides were, frankly, you know, black text on white background with a ton of bullets, and we probably messed up the order of the slides.
Yes.
So, you know, from time to time, we especially Chet tends to steal my slides, and we end up talking about the stuff we're not supposed to talk about. So, but it still works because, you know, it's a domain we understand, we know how to engage, and I think that's the key.
Yeah, and I've had people ask about, like, you know, how do you create beautiful slides too, and, you know, thinking a lot about the design details. You do that, and that's one of the things that I think I benefit from doing talks with you.
When I have the patience to, I mean, you have the patience to wait for me to start working on the slides, because I tend to do it at the last minute.
Yes.
Which drives you nuts.
Yes.
But I make them pretty.
Yes.
Not all the time, less and less.
And it is, I think it's nice to have that. I also think, like, that is not important to me. To me, it's, what is the material we're covering? What are the interesting technical details? Since I'm talking to an audience of engineers. And, you know, yeah, the pretty, if we have time and desire to put that in, sure. But I'm actually there more for the experience of giving the talk than, you know, imparting beautiful design.
So, I mean, some of the things we're talking about right now remind me of your, top tips for terrible tech talks.
Yes.
Your funnily titled meta talk about giving talks.
Yes.
And I gave that talk a couple of times with you
yep.
as well.
Yep.
So maybe we could, you know, rewind, and for people who would like to start giving public talk, like, how should they start? Because, you know, we said, like, oh, you know, you should just get on stage, because the only way to acquire the experience is to start doing it.
Right.
But how do you get there?
So, there's a couple ways. One is, okay, well, you can always, you know, give that talk, sign yourself up for giving a tech talk in your company or a talk at a user group, something that's, you know, a little lower pressure than a huge conference.
Well, it's not just pressure, right? It's also having to go through the selection of the
yes.
talks. I mean, and we still right. go through that every time even in conferences internal to Google, like when we give talks at Google I/O or Android Developer Summit, Chad and I, we submit talks internally, and sometimes they're accepted and sometimes they're not. Like last year, I think we only ended up giving a talk because Jake had a baby.
Yes. That was very, very kind of his wife.
Right. Otherwise, we're not part of the event.
Yeah, we submitted a talk and then we abstained. We were on the committee selecting talks and we said, well, you know what, let's abstain because, you know, we shouldn't be voting on our own talk. And so everybody else rejected it.
But so my point, so that, you know, that can be, that's a higher barrier of entry, whereas maybe a user group might be easier to get into.
Right. And frankly, these places are dying for content, right? They have a meeting every single month, typically, and they want somebody to get up there and talk about this stuff. So join that user group, be a part of that, and give talks about the things that you care about. But to me, like, that is one element of practicing. The more important element for the talks that I've given is just being comfortable on stage, right? Anything that you do that puts yourself in front of people is practice for giving a good technical talk.
Well, and I think that's why it becomes also difficult to give advice, because what makes you comfortable is not necessarily what makes somebody else comfortable. For instance, the way we like to give talks is we have minimal preparation. We mostly improvise. Usually the level of preparation we have is because, you know, there's two of us on stage. We roughly divide the slides to know who's going to talk about what. Very often it's meant also to make the talk more dynamic. We try to because you see a lot of talks where they're going to they switch speaker like halfway through the talk, but we try to bounce back and forth to keep, you know, the audience
more interleaved. And
also, frankly, we like it because since we improvise, I think it's always nice to have someone else next to you. It's easy to forget about a point you wanted to make when you're talking, and the person next to you can be your support and they can interject. And very often, you know, maybe it seems that that was on purpose, but no, it wasn't. You know, if I said something in one of Chet's sections, I was not supposed to say that. Just Chet forgot, or I just thought about it on stage.
Yep.
But we are comfortable with that. Not everybody will be. So what we do may not apply to you. Which is why sometimes, you know, when I see like all those articles about how you should rehearse and how often and how many times, I don't quite like it, because it's not the only way. It is a way, but you should try several different approaches and find the one that is good for you.
Right. Yeah, I try to make that clear in, like, the, you know, when I give talks about giving talks, or the article that I wrote about it. Like, this is something that works for me. Like, I do not rehearse. I do not script. We do not
for the talks that we give.
Keynotes is a totally different thing. Oh my gosh, is that highly scripted?
And we don't like it.
No, it's way not fun. But that format works for us because we have, you know, years of doing this, especially years of doing this together, and sort of knowing how we can both jump in and out and interleave.
And so it's all like it's also like, you know, clues, like it's like using our bodies or like small gestures, like we know what the other person means. So like definitely having that experience with one another like helps, and you don't get that like out of the box.
Right. Here's one you may see in a talk if you ever see a talk by us. In the last 5 minutes of giving the talk, one of us will probably raise a hand behind the laptop and twiddle the finger, because it's clear to us that we have way more content than we have time left, and we should really speed up. So that one works for us, but I also know really good speakers that do script their talks. They do practice, and they are really good. So that works for them. I think everybody needs to figure out their personal style, which is one of the reasons to get up and practice. But I think, like, even if your style is not that, you know, get up and sort of make stuff up approach, just getting comfortable in front of people, I think, is a lot of the battle with public speaking. Because if you're up there worried about what people are thinking about you, then you're not focused on your content. So it's kind of good to get past that and realize that it'll be okay.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, especially if you've been an attendee at a conference, you go to a talk because you like the topic, you've seen the abstract, or you like the speaker. So kind of by definition, the audience is on your side. They're not here to see you fail, or, you know, if you do make a mistake, and we've made many, many mistakes on stage, you know, keep going. Nobody will mind. Like, they're still here to listen to you, and they're supporting you. I don't think I ever remember seeing an audience being like against the speaker. I think
no.
You would have to be really terrible.
Just insulting the audience. They are there to learn the content, and they want to have a good time doing it. So whatever you can do to roll that along would be good.
But that goes both ways. I think, you know, you also have to respect the fact that they chose to go to your talk and not another, because usually, especially at larger conferences, there are multiple tracks and can be difficult to choose the topic that you prefer. And so, you know, I've been to talks where either the speaker spends like, you know, 5 minutes at the beginning talking about themselves, or they will talk about their company or how they're hiring, things like this. And to me, that's kind of like a respect. You know, they chose to come to your talk. It's their time. Try to make it worth it for them.
So there is a related dynamic where, okay, a little bit of background. We went to a conference in Turin last year, DroidCon Turin, and they had an interesting dynamic there where it was an open space, and the sound in open spaces can be really difficult, right? Like somebody on stage A is going to hear what somebody on stage B is doing. So instead, what they did was they had the speaker speak into, obviously, a microphone, but it's not being broadcast in the arena. Instead, it's going out to headphones. And so everybody in the audience is wearing headphones, and the color of the headphone indicated which talk they were listening to. So you could, as a speaker, see the headphones switch from your talk to somebody else's in real time, which is actually just an easier way of something that you'll see in talks anyway, which is somebody will get up in the middle and leave the room. And the important point is, don't worry about it. Like, everybody has reasons to get up. Either the, you know, the topic didn't appeal to them.
Maybe they've got a lot to drink.
Maybe. It really doesn't matter. And your focus should be on, you know, the content and going ahead with your talk. Like, don't really get too involved with, you know, what is going on in the audience, especially, you know, things that are potentially negative like that. Don't worry about it. Like, make sure that they're engaged and see if there's, you know, you need to tune what you're doing, but don't really, you know, bum out about that and then go inside your head. Just focus on the talk.
Yeah, and I've rarely seen speakers who get into that space where they get, you know, flustered because they make a mistake, therefore, like, they start thinking about it, and then you just, so it becomes this vicious circle. And I think, you know, what happens that, especially if you do end up giving a talk about a topic, like you said, that you're passionate about, turns out that, you know, we're engineers. That's what we do all day. We talk about stuff, you know, that the other party probably doesn't care about, but we keep talking because we're passionate. So once you're on stage, like, it, I feel it's natural. Like, once you start the discussion, you're just having a discussion. And it's getting started. That's the hardest part.
Yep. That's
kicking
an interesting
off the talk.
What's that?
Kicking off the talk.
Right.
The first few minutes.
Yeah. That it's an interesting dynamic where, like, you would think, you know, we've been on stage so many times. Clearly, we're comfortable up there. I am happy up there, but not comfortable. Right. And it's the beginning of the talk that's actually the hardest. Like, all of that adrenaline, the nervousness sort of builds up, and just starting the talk, I find to be the hardest thing. This is why I've noticed too, like, if I ask a question in a public talk, I'm completely nervous. And you can even hear it in my voice when I'm doing that, because that is the beginning of the talk, right? I just opened my mouth. I'm trying to get all my words in the proper order to say this thing. And I only have limited time. And, like, everything is really pent up in my brain going
into
this.
Also, what they don't see is that have you on a leash so that you don't run off the stage.
But once you get flowing, then it is a lot easier. So one of the tricks that I started doing, unbeknownst to me, I just noticed it a couple of years later, was I'll actually start the talk before I start the talk. So I'll start having casual conversation with the audience. You know, I'll make a joke, or I'll notice something that happened, or I'll comment on something that happened on the way up to the stage, whatever it is. And then by the time the talk actually starts, it's already started. Right, so it helps me diffuse that.
It's also part of engaging the audience, right? It's, you know, creating that connection where you just don't start right away with something really academic.
Yep.
You know, you're having a discussion, so first say hi, how are you doing, and then
record their responses one by one,
and then get them bored.
So you had mentioned co-speakers before. That's an interesting topic because, like, so we I prefer that method. I've never actually asked
you about
it.
I don't know. You do more and more talks without me. I'm starting to, I'm waiting for the day you're going to tell me, like, you know, it's over, Roma.
This is my opportunity.
It was the last talk.
Broadway called. I prefer it because I think, as you said, I think it makes the talks more engaging because, like, I don't know what the hell I'm going to say. I certainly don't know what you're going to say. So the audience has no idea what's going on, right?
And also, frankly, it's an opportunity for more jokes.
It is. Funny things happen when you have no idea what's going on stage. But if you do that, like, I would highly recommend that if you want to make talks fun for you as well as for the audience. And it can help cut down on the work. Like, we normally divide it up, you know, I'll create slides for this section. Roman will go off and learn the code and how this thing works for that other. And then it just cuts down on the amount that both of us need to do to create a single talk. So it works really well for us. However, depending on who your co-speaker is and what their comfort level is, then you kind of want to do it a little bit differently. So the dynamic you talked about was like we interleave very, it's not randomly. We know essentially what we're going to say.
It's also sometimes random.
Sometimes, unfortunately, it is. But yeah, we can jump in and out, but generally we're responsible for sections of these talks. With other co-speakers where maybe either they didn't have as much experience on stage or they were really nervous or I just don't know their personality type well enough, I will stay out of their way. Like I will do intro and then walk off stage or first section.
I've done the same where you definitely don't want to interrupt them, especially if it's their first talk and they're not used to it, or, you know, if you don't know them well enough, don't joke.
Yeah. Yeah. You're just going to confuse them, right?
Or, you know, insult them or something. And the other thing with a co-speaker, I know it can be very tempting because I've seen that happen many times. It can be very tempting to script more heavily, especially the transitions. And I've never seen them work, you know, when it becomes like, and now Chet will tell you about, and like you're pointing to the wrong side of the stage. Yeah. It's like, oh, thank you, Romain. Yes.
There was even, there was one I saw in the last couple of years, doesn't matter what it was or where the transitions were correct, but they were unnecessary, right? So the speaker who was speaking would say, okay, and now speaker B is going to tell you about so-and-so, and then speaker B would say, thank you.
And I think because the most common example of having multiple speakers on stage is keynotes. And in keynotes, again, it's very different. First of all, everything is scripted to the second. And also the speakers, you know, just to keep the presentation clean, the speakers are not all on stage at the same time, so they have to walk in. So you need that transition. You need to talk about it. And also you don't want someone random to suddenly show up. You have to explain who they are and what they're going to talk about.
Yep.
But a tech talk is different. You can have two or three speakers on stage waiting, and you should introduce them at the beginning, so you don't have to do that in the middle of the talk.
Yep. But you can also build in a lot more assumptions. So in a keynote, like we may be doing a keynote where we're going to be talking about Android, and then somebody is going to come up next and talk about Chrome. Well, that's a context switch, and it's good to tell the audience, here's the context switch, right? So, thanks, and now you're going to hear from so-and-so who's going to tell you about Chrome, and the audience will make that context switch. In a tech talk where you're all talking about the same domain, you don't need to point out to them that, okay, and now this person is going to come up and tell you how the menu item works in this tool, right? It doesn't matter. They're going to start talking about the menu item, and the audience is already in that context. They didn't need that explanation, so just cut it out.
I would say show, don't tell, but that doesn't make sense in a talk. You're supposed to tell.
Yeah, unless you're doing like a mime presentation. We haven't done one of those.
We have not tried that one. Okay, but so to be honest, there are times when we script our transitions. It's a very specific case when we do those comedy talks together.
Yes.
That's a very different beast.
Yes.
And those tend to be a little more prepared. And more importantly, something we do with those talks that maybe we should do with tech talks as well, but we don't, is when we give those talks multiple times, we go and watch the previous time we gave the talk, not because we like ourselves so much, but we listen to the reaction of the audience to the jokes. And we tweak, we cut stuff and we add stuff and we tweak the talk based on the reactions that we can hear in the recordings. But yeah, we've never done that for tech talks because I guess it's a little harder because you probably already have your story. It's about explaining like technical stuff and you can't really remove things or add things.
I think also it depends on the priority. Like with the only reason to do the comedy talk is to help people laugh, right? So if they're not laughing, then something is wrong with the content. With the tech talk, we're imparting information. If they laugh, that's great, but that's not why we're there. And so I would never, like, I don't script jokes into the talks that I do, and I wouldn't really change the content, you know, here's a way to make this funnier. Well, that's not why I'm there, right?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. We've had people come to us, and, you know, on one hand, it's a little, it feels good, you know, someone who comes to us and say, hey, you know, I don't even do Android development, but I come to your talks anyway because your guys are funny or entertaining. So that's great. But our main goal, to be clear, is to teach something.
As long as, you know, the people that are developers are actually learning, then that's why we're there.
Yeah. And we said that we're nervous when we give a tech talk. I don't know about you, but giving the comedy talks, I'm not nervous. I'm terrified. It's so much more personal, and it's also about something you don't do all day, right? So you don't have this level of comfort. It's not a discussion anymore. It's more of a show.
Yeah.
And it's a lot harder.
It is weird because then it's down to, you know, timing and actually landing a punchline. Like in the tech talk, if I think of something funny and it doesn't land, I don't really care. But in the comedy talk, like, well, then I shouldn't have said it.
Especially when we bomb several times in a row, like you start sweating.
There was that one time.
Like, yeah. Oh, painful. But anyway, back to regular tech talks. So yeah, I think, you know, having a co-speaker or not, if you have someone that you're comfortable with, like someone you know really well, you should try it because I think it helps. Reduces the amount of work, you get a different point of view. I know, you know, we disagree on a lot of things when we prepare the slides, but I think it's better for the talk overall because, you know, just different point of view. And it's like writing code, you know, just talking about the architecture or how you're going to write an algorithm. Usually when you collaborate, you know, the result is better. But again, like, yeah, do what's the most comfortable thing for you.
Yep. Including that whole rehearsing thing, including anything that goes into like your style and the way that you prepare. I think you will learn that over time and do the thing that works for you.
But there are things to avoid. Like, so for instance, you know, making jokes, we do it a little less than we used to, probably because now there are more comedy talks that are an outlet for that.
Yes.
But don't, you know, force, don't add jokes if you don't feel comfortable making them up on the spot. Like, it's not going to go well most of the time, or you can tell that, especially, you know, a lot of the times jokes just won't work.
Yep.
Or they have worked and they don't work with that particular audience. And when the joke was scripted and you bombed.
So awkward.
Yes, unless you're very comfortable on stage, you can see that the speaker get flustered and that doesn't help. So don't do things that can get in your way if you can avoid them. And that's one of them. And rehearsing, it can be good if you're comfortable with rehearsing, do it. But the key is to do it a ton. I would say either don't do it or do it a lot, but don't do it in between. And we see that with keynotes, right? Like when we help with keynotes or we're part of the keynote, there's a ton of rehearsing going on to the point that at the end it becomes, I mean, you're acting really, right?
Yep.
And even when there are jokes in the keynote, like you've been rehearsing them so much that, you know, they come out naturally. And you internally feel weird because you've heard it so many times.
And you'll notice this too in things like keynotes, like the people that are saying things naturally because they really have rehearsed it over and over and over again versus you rely on the teleprompter and people will end up reading that, which brings us to speaker notes.
Speaker notes. Yeah, they can be used for different things. I've seen a lot of talks that use them where they have the entire script in the notes. And I think that's dangerous because it will encourage you to read your notes. And frankly, if all you're going to do on stage is read your notes, you might as well write an article. It's going to be better for the audience. That can have a benefit if you distribute the slides afterwards because there's going to be, you know, extensive notes and explanations about the slides. Our notes tend to be just small indicators or markers. The main note we use is just the name of the speaker that's going to talk about the slide. So it's just going to say Chet or Romain. Sometimes, depending, especially when we do like what's new in Android, I tend to put a little more. I generally have a couple sentences because we talk about, and I'm pretty sure it's obvious on stage, we talk about topics that we don't understand that well.
What?
Yeah, like biometric and security. And so we need this information, especially, you know, in the context of some talks like what's new, there are messages or information that we as Android or Google wants to get out, and we want to make sure we don't forget about them. In a more technical tech talk, our notes can be like just a few words, like some keywords, like key concepts we want to hit, but that's about it.
Yeah.
They're really reminders. I mean, they're like your cheat sheet, nothing else.
Right. I mean, the main thing I think of is the slides should be the reminders. There should be just enough information on the slide to remind you what you were going to say.
Yeah, I think the key here is, I completely agree with you, but, you know, especially when you start using animations like build and reveals, yep, even when your secondary screen for the speaker, so you're going to see generally your time, the current slide and the next slide, even seeing the next slide sometimes is not enough to remember like all the steps of the animation. So the speaker notes are here. They're the longer story.
Right.
So having both, I think, is helpful.
Yep. The thing that I noticed a few years ago was like there was particular, I don't know, it was a talk I was doing with you, and there was a particular section where I was like, oh, this is really tricky. Let me just write down this, you know, it was like two or three sentences just to make sure that I nail that. And in real time, I was on stage and I looked down and I saw speaker notes with a paragraph of information. And I had a choice. I could either read and parse that to remind myself what it was, or I could ignore it and just keep talking to the audience and figure that I was going to get the salient points. And I chose to do the latter. And that's when I realized, like, if I do put too much information in there, I'm just going to ignore it anyway. So I go for like 2 to 3 words, because I can look down, get the words in my brain immediately while my mouth is still open and talking, instead of having to pause and sort of breaking my flow.
Yeah, when I use more than a few words, it's usually just to explain the builds. For instance, in code, sometimes it can be surprising. You're giving your explanation and you forgot that there's 2 more lines of code will appear. So I kind of like having, you know, just a few reminders of how many steps there's going to be.
I've also seen a lot of people that use indicators in the speaker notes for when they should click, especially for animations where there's something specific going on, and then you know when you're going to click, and therefore this other thing is going to happen.
Yeah, just like in keynotes.
Yes, exactly. So another question that I've had from some people, I don't think I have a very good answer for this one, but okay, so they want to do some talks, but how do they get accepted? So we mentioned, you know, the meetups and stuff like that. I think that is certainly the way to go, because that gets you A, the experience, and B, the exposure. And then you can start saying, hey, I gave this talk there. But sometimes, you need to somehow pitch the case for the people organizing this thing that they should have you as a speaker, right? And I think the key element is, what is it you want to talk about that the audience will want to hear about? I think we are in an unusual situation for most people, which is we work at a place with a developer platform that people want to know more about, right? So we have a bit of an advantage there, just that, well, we can talk about this thing that people want to know about. But that doesn't mean that you also don't know things that people want to know about for either, you know, that platform or some other library, something that you've done, a use case, whatever it is.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that question is a little trickier to answer, because different folks will have different expectations from talks. I know that you and I, we do enjoy deeply technical talks. So I on a purely personal level, would encourage any would-be speaker to submit something that would go into like deep technical explanations about a particular topic or a particular implementation that they think could be valuable to others. And honestly, like I think that can be helpful nowadays, because we go to a lot of conferences and there are some technical, like deeply technical talks, but it's not the vast majority, I think.
Yeah.
And you kind of want to find something that to differentiate yourself from the other talks. So if you're just going to go give yet another talk on dependency injection or, you know, RxJava, but you stick with the API level stuff you can learn from the Java doc or from the samples, chances are your talk is not going to get accepted. I think that works when there are new technologies that come out, like, you know, recently with coroutines. We've seen a lot of talks on coroutines, and it's fine if they're a little more superficial because it's something new that everybody has to learn, and the best practices are not yet known. But in general, like if you can find something that is just not, that just doesn't exist, right, at conferences, like your chances of getting accepted will be higher. Now, of course, the problem is when you do that, you can end up being niche, which is another reason why your talk would not get accepted. And I know that for you now, you know, we love to talk about graphics, and the talks we like to give, I think, would not get accepted anywhere because they would be too niche. I think they would be interesting. They're not directly applicable. And it's always a gamble for a conference, like, oh, do we want to get it to have a talk that's just interesting versus something that's immediately useful to the attendees?
Yep. And then sometimes, you know, if that works out, you can do the niche talk and do the broader thing. Like, here's the thing that people, you know, everybody needs to know about. And then maybe if there's extra space, you can do this other thing that's, you know, more your sort of passion. But, I mean, the other part of this, though, is you should be submitting talks on things that you really care about, because if you don't, that'll come through. It will not be a fun talk for the audience, right? The energy that you have on stage imparts itself to the audience. That helps the audience, A, get it, and B, have a good time getting it. And if you're just up there like, well, people wanted to know about RxJava, here's this API.
Yeah, and to be honest, another thing that makes it difficult to get into accepted at a conference is the fact that, you know, there's a limited number of sessions and the organizers want to make sure that the talks are good and that the attendees are happy with the content. And part of it is getting speaker on stage that the organizers know will deliver, yep, like a good talk, right? And the only way to know that is to pick speakers that have already given talks that you know are good. And so I think that's partly why at a lot of conferences you cannot see like the same speakers over and over again, because they're safe.
Yeah. Right?
It's safe for the organization. And so starting with, you know, places like user groups is a way to just get some of your content out there to help the organizer like understand that you've given talks, you're comfortable, that you know the content is of quality. It can be really hard to get your first talk accepted at a conference. Not impossible, right? But it's going to be more difficult.
I've noticed in call for papers forms recently, like they're asking for more and more information so that they can make the right choices for the conference. Including there was a conference that I submitted to this year that asked me for a minimum 500 word description. Which I had to fill out with 300 words of ipsum lorem because I had nothing more to say. It was pretty easy to describe it quickly. But they will ask for things like links to videos, right? So they do ask, you know, simple questions about what's your speaking experience. But if you talk at a user group and there happens to be a video of that, awesome. Because then you can say, not only have I done this before and I'm comfortable doing this and it's going to be awesome, but here's a video and you can see that, you know, proof of point. So, yeah. Get that experience and use that to then build up to the events that, you know, you want to participate in.
Yeah, and of course, there's the opposite that happens too. Like, you know, you and I have been part of several selection committees over the year. Like, you used to do Java one,
yep.
Helped 1 year. And sometimes, you know, there was a speaker who got a talk 1 year and like we or the organizers like saw the outcome, and if they submit a talk the year after that, they may not get that talk accepted because, you know, it didn't work.
Yep.
And it's hard to do that because, you know, one talk is just one talk. That doesn't mean that, you know, they are a bad speaker forever. It might just have been a fluke, but,
yep.
You know, again, you're doing that for the attendees.
I should point out too, like we joke or talk a lot about like, oh, you know, we don't rehearse and we don't script. We care deeply about our talks, right? I'm not saying people should get up there and just wing it, because chances are that is not going to work out.
Actually, surprisingly, yeah, we don't rehearse, but we, and like any speaker, I think the amount, the number of hours that go into the creating the slides or, you know, the cut snippets or the demos or even sometimes just the videos, the diagrams, the animations, I mean, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It really depends on the talk. Like sometimes it's a lot easier. For instance, what's new in Android, you know, it's not hard to write the slides. What's hard is chasing down, is gathering all the information. And we rely on other folks. I mean, Chet does most of the work, but we rely on other folks at Google who help us. So there's like dozens of man hours involved in just gathering the information.
Yeah.
And then surprisingly, even with just the slides, you know, you start with the content, and we, especially Chet and I, we always have way too much content, and just cutting it down, reducing the amount of words on the slides, you know, simplifying the message, like streamlining the story or the message that you want to put out there, takes a lot of time. So we don't rehearse, but yeah, it's a lot of work. And it's work that we tend to do on our spare time because we have a job to do. Well, now it's your job, but I suppose.
Yes, that's the bit that I flipped. So by the time, I mean, exactly, we spend a lot of time on the content. So by the time the event comes up, we actually know the content really well. We may not know the words that are going to come out of our mouths to describe the content, but we know the slides deeply because we've been working on them for far too long.
Yeah, a recent example was that talk we gave, Kotlin Under the Hood, Under the Cover or Uncovered, depending on which version you've attended.
Yes.
The slides themselves, I mean, I think they're some of our most horrible slides we've ever made because they're just, you know, ton of like bytecode, like black on white. We didn't put any effort in making it pretty, but we spent a lot of time like looking at the implementation of various features in Kotlin, writing, you know, looking at all the features of the language, writing different programs, different approaches, decompiling the code, understanding the bytecode, trying to figure out like, is it bad? Is it good? To come up with the actual slides.
Yeah.
So that was, and usually we do our talks, I mean, not last minute, depends, sometimes they are really last minute, but that's one of the talks that I think we started like way earlier than usual because we knew it would require like a lot of work ahead of time.
Yep.
It was not just a matter of writing slides.
Yeah, depending on the kind of talk you're wanting to give, you may need to dive really deeply into a topic, like write a bunch of code, not just, you know, look through the API docs and see how this thing works, but actually get it into your brain. Write the code, write the samples, see how things work, debug it, profile, whatever you need to do, so that by the time you get around to writing the slides, you really know how this thing works. And then by the time you get around to giving the slides, you can look at a slide and say, oh, this is where I was going to talk about so-and-so. Let me tell you about this thing.
Yeah, talks we gave in the past, for instance, the Filthy Rich Clients or Extreme GUI Makeover that were about Swing and Java 2D on desktop, we would build like entire applications, like demos that were used to explain a bunch of effects or features of the platform. And just writing those apps, like, you know, with two or three people would easily take, you know, a few weeks before we could actually start writing the talk.
Yep. And then we never rehearse, but we do actually walk through the slides. Usually for any talk that we're giving for the first time, especially, we'll sit down, you know, we'll grab an hour in a conference room, maybe a half hour, and we'll actually go through the slides and basically mimic something that we may say on those slides.
The main point of doing that is to check the dynamic, to see if the, you know, like I said, we want to go back and forth. So it's to make sure, like, we are not lopsided one way or another, or we try to not have, you know, 2/3 of the talk given by one of us and just 1/3 by the other, especially because we feel stupid being on stage not saying anything for 40 minutes. Also to make sure that the order of the slides, the explanation makes sense, that, you know, you have the correct flow through the presentation.
Right. And what we should be doing is timing ourselves because, okay, so the downside...
But that never works. Like guests. We just fill whatever time we have.
The dirty secret to our, you know, no rehearsal approach is we're really bad at timing our presentations so that we'll reach the end of time. You know, that's why we do the finger twiddle in the last 5 minutes because we realize,
I would argue we're good at it because there are presentations we've given in half an hour and we've gave the same presentation in an hour and a half.
Yep.
So, like I said, we'll just fill whatever time we have.
I mean, this comes into the, like, practice to get comfortable on stage. When you're comfortable on stage, then you can sort of expand and contract to fill the time. Like, that happens to work for us. But it is the downside. If you're going to go up and, you know, have the unrehearsed approach, be careful about that time factor.
Yeah, you make a good point about time. And I think what works for us is because we've been doing it for long enough that we have a rough idea of how much content we need. And in our case, we know that about once... 60 slides, we can do it in 40 to 60 minutes. So about a slide per minute. And then, you know, sometimes we'll be too slow, sometimes we'll be too fast, but we can adapt on stage. But I know that Jake Wharton, for instance, uses a lot of magic move transitions for the animations on his slides. We tend to do animations, they're called what, builds or actions in Keynote. Yeah. So they're animations that are part of a slide, but you can also like use multiple slides and have automatic animations when you transition from one to the other. It's two ways of building animations. So we tend to keep our animations within one slide. So that's still one slide per minute. And Jake, for instance, uses more slides because that's how he creates animations. So for him, in 40 minutes, he will go through, you know, 200, 300 slides. But it's not that there's more content. It's just the way that...
He might argue that point, but yeah.
Well, okay. Well, the content may be better than ours. That's a different that's a different topic. But yeah, so you have to, you know, figure out for yourself like how you write slides and what, you know, how much time that amounts to. And we can't answer that for you, really. I kind of like the rule of like one slide per minute for us because it's easy.
So I was just thinking of a classic example of my inability to time things where I think it was like the second satire talk that I gave at DevOx. And they gave me 15 minutes. You know, that's not much time. And so I scribbled the slides together.
Comedy talk is a lot.
Apparently, yes. So I scribbled the slides. I'm like, you know, I've got 30 slides to go through. So sure, this is going to work. And I gave the slides and I looked up and 4 minutes had elapsed of my 15. And then I just went into Q&A. And it turns out that the Q&A is actually better than the slides in all of these talks. It's the most fun.
And the reason you do Q&A in your comedy talks is because you messed up the first time.
Yes, exactly. I learned something important.
My fear is to not have enough content. I think we're the same. So we'll always end up having way too much.
Yes.
So I remember attending a talk that was a long, long time ago. But the talk was, they were 50 minutes back then. And the speaker was done in 25. And it felt weird. And for some reason, like, I really don't want to be that speaker.
Yes. Oh, speaking of which, adrenaline does weird things to time. right? Time dilates when you're on stage. And so you may have actually rehearsed this or gone over, you know, some version of this thing before, and you're thinking, okay, this is going to last 45 minutes. And then you get up on stage and 32 minutes later, you're done because you will speak faster.
Yeah. Well, it's a mix of that. Plus, if you have a lot of content, you will naturally accelerate.
Yep.
And when you combine both, well, that's too fast.
Yep.
And I know we do that, especially. I know I speak too fast.
And you'll also, I tend to go into more detail on things. Like something interesting comes up on a slide, and then I'll just start into some paragraph that you didn't expect.
And I'm right behind Chad going, shut up.
So then we make up for it at the end of the talk and race through the last few slides, and it's all good.
It's all good. So yeah, I think that abuts covering. And then there are other tips that you give in your talk, but things like agenda slides, I think, are not that necessary.
Yep.
They can be useful in deeply complex technical explanations just to, remind people what steps you are at, but that's not about the entire talk. That's within the talk in a particular section. You might want to just have a reminder of, what stage you're at. For instance, when we describe how layout and drawing works, we're going to have a diagram that show you where you stand in the whole process. But
right.
Agenda, or especially agenda slides that start with agenda as the first item.
Yeah, I tend to think of it that each talk should have a very clear outline, even when it's something like what's new in Android. Well, it's pretty clear. It's basically a scattershot of things that we categorize, into these vague buckets. But it's a clear flow that everybody can follow. In a technical talk that's more about a specific domain, there should be a clear flow to that as well. And if the flow is clear enough and simple enough, then you don't need an agenda slide. But if it's hard for the users, for the audience to have a mental model of what you're talking about, that's when an agenda slide is kind of nice.
And frankly, you can kind of hide an agenda in your talk. For instance, when one of the talks we gave about graphics on Android, it was a hodgepodge of graphics techniques and performance and various other things. So there were sections in the talk, and each section was using a different color, and there was a title slide, and you just use it as a segue into say, oh, and now we're going to talk about performance. But you don't need to remind people about what we already talked about and what's coming after what you're about to talk about. It would be like in a book if they put the table of content between every chapter. Why?
We did the same thing in the history talk, which clearly had a clear outline anyway. But every few slides, we would have an interstitial slide with a timeline that indicated, and now we're going to be talking about this release. And it looked very similar to slides you'd seen before. So it was just kind of an implicit agenda. Yeah.
So the agenda slide, the bio, of course, you should introduce yourself. And, you can say like who you are, where you work, but nobody will care about what degree you have, what school you went to, what you had for lunch.
Answer the question for the audience, why am I an okay person to be talking about this topic right now? And then move on as quick as you can.
Well, you're on stage, so.
Yeah, I have the microphone.
Chances are it's not random.
Yes. What else? Oh, so some of the things we're talking about now come from templates. So organizers of conference will typically send you a template, say, here, use this for your slides.
Depends on the conference.
It does.
I see that happens less and less.
Okay.
Google I/O, I think, is still the main one for us.
Yeah. But some of these templates or some, practices you've seen elsewhere may lead you to believe that you have to do all these things, and they're all options. See if it works for you for the content.
And I think it's, a template can be useful if you really don't know what you want to do or you don't care. But it's interesting, especially nowadays, we've seen, I think, over the past 15 years giving talks, they used to be to all look the same with like bullet points and agenda slides. And now like all the talks, even at the same conference, have very different styles and forms. And I think it's great because that means you can choose whatever form visually or, the flow or whatever that fits your content. Sometimes, you're told that you shouldn't have too many words on the slide. Well, sometimes that's actually the right thing to do. Sometimes, or maybe you'll give a talk that's just, hand-drawn because that works for what you're saying. So don't think too hard about the templates. Like, do what you think is best for your content. It's better this way.
Yeah, the organizers do not know, right? They're taking guesses and they're starting with some baseline that, may help everybody get to stage one. But they don't know what you're going to talk about, so make the decisions for them instead. You're the one that knows the content. How do people choose conferences? I wonder if that's something that comes up as well. Like if you're
choosing
going
which conference to go to?
I think the more domain specific, the more interesting, probably.
Yeah, I think it's hard for us to answer because we're lucky enough that, you know, Google will cover our expenses. It's part of our job, so we don't have to worry about taking vacation, paying for it, or asking the conference to cover the expense. Some conferences will cover the expenses, some won't. That can be a big factor.
Yep.
I know that when I was doing that, I was still a student, I was lucky enough that all conferences were understanding and would cover my expenses. So that means that, you know, I would go wherever someone wanted me. But again, that was easy because, you know, I didn't have a job. So, or I mean, I had a job. I would just skip class to go to give talks. But yeah, so that one, I don't think we're the right persons to answer.
Yeah,
I mean, we can answer like how we pick the conferences, and it's mostly based on how many times have we traveled this year. especially when, like, well, Chad, that's different now, but it's not my job to do this technically. So I don't want to abuse this position. So yeah, I'm not going to go to a conference like once a month. That would be too much. I have an actual job to do. There's also, you know, for us, because Google covers the expenses, and in my case, like, is nice enough to let me do this thing I enjoy. I try to go to conferences that have enough attendees that I feel like it's worth Google's time and money. That means, you know, there are places I'd love to go to, especially because I know that, you know, countries where not that many known speakers go, but. So something we've tried to do recently is, you know, to pack several conferences close to each other, or do like a user group and a conference. So, you know, we get more out of the travel.
Right. Yeah. So some of the stuff, we've been pretty successful at some of the trips that we've done in Paris, where we'll go over for something like Android Makers and then see if we can also organize a user group either in Paris or surrounding cities.
Yeah, actually, we're just doing that at the end of the month, right? We're going to Crete, and I think we're doing, what, 3 different events?
Yeah, I mean, they did this for us this time, so that worked out pretty well. Right. There's 3 separate events, but even when that's not the case, like, we'll just ask, oh, you know, we're doing this thing here. Is it possible? Is there some user group? And if they don't set one up, they know people who do.
Yeah, and it just doesn't hurt to ask. I mean, if you're going somewhere to give a talk at a conference, ask about the local user groups. They might be happy for you to give the same talk or just another topic that might be more niche that you really care about. And worst case scenario, they say no.
So this is sort of one of the 4 things that I think about when I'm choosing some conference to go to. It's how far away is it, and therefore how much time is it going to take? I mean, there is the money concern as well, but honestly, the time is huge, right? If we're doing something in Europe, there goes a week of your life. Traveling there, traveling back, jet lag, preparing for the conference, whatever it is, there goes a week. So you want to make sure that it's worth it in terms of number of attendees, which you mentioned, as well as do they record these things so that you can scale the content beyond the people that happen to be in the room at the time. And then yeah, just try to amortize it with other events. I don't know if that was 4, but it was 4 in my mind.
It was 4 in your mind, so that's good.
I'm drawing a blank now. Have we covered everything possible in the area of outreach?
Pretty much. What is everything we can cover in an hour? I think we are.
Sure.
We have to wrap this up.
So we'll call it there. And talk about this again real soon now. Thanks.
Thank you for being such a wonderful guest, Chet.
Thank you.